from Waynesburg to Altoona, Du Bois to Camp Hill, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Governor Tom Wolf has received an F report card grade for his excessively slow reopening of the Pennsylvania economy. Phil Kirpin from the Committee to Unleash Prosperity is here to talk about why the governor was given a failing grade. The Westmoreland Sanctuary in New York is a pristine nature and wildlife preserve. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has Ann Paul from the Westmoreland Sanctuary in the Community Benefit Spotlight. And recovering from the COVID-19 shutdown will require the elimination of unnecessary regulations on businesses. Ashley Klingensmith of Americans for Prosperity PA has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Phil Kirpin from the Committee to Unleash Prosperity in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Donald Trump and Joe Biden each glided virtually unopposed to wins in the Pennsylvania primary this past week, as both parties' presidential nominations had been decided months ago. Races for the three statewide offices on the ballot also have come into focus. Pittsburgh City Controller Michael Lamb has apparently won the Democrat nomination for Auditor General. That seat is open as incumbent Auditor General Eugene DePasquale is term limited and cannot run for re-election. Lamb prevailed in a six-way primary and will now face Dauphin County Controller Tim DeFore, who was unopposed for the Republican nomination. In the race for state treasurer, both incumbent Democrat Joe Torsella and Republican challenger Stacey Garrity were unopposed for their party nominations. The race for attorney general will pit incumbent Democrat Josh Shapiro against former Allegheny County Councilwoman Heather Heidelbaugh. The Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission has announced it will lay off 500 employees. Most of those losing their jobs are toll collectors. The Turnpike put an end to cash fare collections a couple of months ago when the coronavirus pandemic hit. Plans had been to move to a toll-by-plate system anyhow, but the pandemic accelerated those plans. Additionally, the Turnpike has experienced more than a 50% drop in traffic due to business closure and stay-at-home orders issued during the pandemic. That has resulted in a loss of over $100 million in revenue. The Turnpike Commission is considering early retirement incentives, cuts in capital projects, and other options in an effort to reduce costs. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. FreedomWorks and the Committee to Unleash Prosperity have put together a report card on how well governors have been doing in reopening their state's economies in the wake of COVID-19 business closure and stay-at-home orders. It comes as no surprise that Tom Wolf is one of five governors to receive an F for his reopening policies. Phil Kirpin is president of the Committee to Unleash Prosperity. He joins us to talk about the report card. Phil, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Phil, the Committee to Unleash Prosperity has conducted a project where they have rated the governors of the 50 states, along with the mayor of the District of Columbia, on their policies relative to reopening their states, and in the case of D.C., the city, in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. Tell us a little bit about how this project got started and what were the metrics that were used.
We saw sort of a lot of these ratings going on that were sort of supposedly, you know, who was good for health. And so basically the most draconian measures were being rated positively without any regard for the consequences for the people, for the economy, for everything attendant to that, which also relates to health as well. And so what we wanted to do was to sort of rate, well, who has sensible economic policies? Who's moving in the direction of getting their economy moving again, getting people back to work, getting jobs, and who's not? And we put these together initially several weeks ago. We've updated them a couple of times since. But the idea was basically to look at who was moving most aggressively to get things back as close to normal as possible, get people back to work, get their economy moving again, lift unnecessary restrictions on people. And then, of course, your state is an interesting one because you did have a lot of disease and deaths, but they were almost entirely in the long-term care facilities, which was a result of policy errors made by your governor and by your Department of Health. And so the idea of having draconian restrictions on the general population and then keeping them going for a long period of time really was economically destructive and unnecessarily so when the problem was in a discrete type of facility and a result largely of policy errors. And so I think we initially, I don't remember if your governor got an F in the first round or if he started as a D and then got downgraded, but we do certainly have him at an F now because of everything that's developed.
So Governor Wolf is at an F, and let's talk more in depth about this whole nursing home situation, Phil, because to me, this is the most egregious component of what the Wolf administration, what the Secretary of Health, Rachel Levine, have done. You have updated numbers on the number of fatalities from COVID-19 that have occurred in nursing and personal care homes relative to the overall numbers. Fill us in on the latest statistics.
As you know, Pennsylvania used to give us a daily report with the total number of long-term care deaths, and it was easy to track what was happening in this on a day-to-day basis. They stopped doing that on May 18th. And so for the last couple of weeks, we've not had the benefit of regular reporting or a total number reported, but we have had a couple of reports that go facility by facility through the entire state, and they have the number of deaths in those, except that if a facility has between one and four deaths, they get an asterisk. It's suppressed. So if it's five or more, they give the number. If it's zero, they give the number. If it's one to four, it's an asterisk. And there are 99 facilities that have those asterisks. And so that's where we've got a little bit of uncertainty right now. But if you assume that all 99 of those have the minimum possible number of deaths, it would be, you know, they just have one in each of those facilities, then you would be looking at, for the state of Pennsylvania, 4,129 deaths in long-term care, which would imply, given the current total number yesterday as of when this report came out, that you had 1,538 total deaths outside of long-term care. About 73% of all the deaths in the state would be in long-term care. If you look at the top end of the range of what's possible, if all those asterisks hid fours behind them, the highest number you might have in long-term care would be 4,426, which would represent 78% of all the deaths in the state, and there would only be 1,241 total deaths outside of long-term care. So we don't have an exact number because they stopped reporting that. We don't get daily updates anymore because they stopped giving us daily updates. But based on the weekly report and looking at the range that's possible with the suppression that they do there, we know that between 73 and 78% of all of the COVID deaths in the state of Pennsylvania are in long-term care facilities, or among residents of long-term care facilities, I should say, because a lot of them are hospitalized prior to dying. But that's a very, very high number. Now, of course, your state has one of the largest long-term care populations of any state. It's about 133,000 people in long-term care in Pennsylvania, which is more than most other states. There are a few that have more. But, you know, that's not necessarily determinative of having this level of outbreak. For instance, Texas has an even larger long-term care population than Pennsylvania does. Texas has over 150,000 people in long-term care, and they only have 790 total long-term care deaths. You've got, you know, obviously, about five or six times that number. And so it's not automatic that a state with a large long-term care population will have this type of problem. That said, there are some states that have a significant higher percentage of their long-term care population that has died. Massachusetts and Connecticut immediately come to mind, as well as New Jersey. New Jersey is about 10% of all of their long-term care residents who have died, and Connecticut's at about 11%. Pennsylvania is about 3.5%, because, as I said, you have a very large long-term care population. But the point that I think is so crucial, and why I think your governor's policies have been so misguided with respect to the whole rest of the economy, is you have a minimal issue outside of the long-term care home. You have a very major issue in them, but you have a minimal issue in the general population, and it doesn't make sense to impose all kinds of draconian restrictions on the general population based on these headline numbers that everyone's seeing, when the headline numbers are, you know, overwhelmingly about 75% in the long-term care facilities.
Let's just stop for 1 second and reflect on that number. 75% of the deaths from COVID-19 in Pennsylvania, north of 4,129 people have died in nursing homes or long-term care facilities. And let's remind listeners that it was the policy of the Pennsylvania Department of Health at the beginning of this outbreak to send residents who had active COVID-19 status back into these facilities from hospitals. And yet just this past week, Dr. Rachel Levine, the Secretary of Health, said, I think it was a good policy. Now, how anybody can think a policy that contributed heavily, if not caused, over 4,000 deaths was a good policy defies any explanation. And Phil, let's even move beyond that. As you've pointed out, 75% of the problem, 75% of the deaths in Pennsylvania have been in these facilities, 25% outside. Yet Pennsylvania, we still have five or six counties that are only now emerging from the so-called red lockdown. We have counties that are in the so-called yellow lockdown, which means businesses still cannot return to normal. And even under green, which is the most lenient, the businesses cannot return to normal. Are other states doing this, or is this a case of where Pennsylvania is a draconian outlier?
There are other states that are as draconian, but I think the interesting thing is that the states that have been the most lenient, that are getting pretty close to business as usual, states like Texas and Florida and Georgia, have not had any notable increase in disease burden as a consequence of that. And so whatever we might think about the merits of the lockdown policies when they were first implemented, and you can have a big debate over whether they were justified even then, it's increasingly clear that there's not much benefit to continuing them and to continuing these types of restrictions relative to just opening up and allowing people to take individual responsibility. And I think fundamentally what was wrong with all of these disease models from the beginning was this idea that if government didn't force people to do things, they wouldn't happen. And the truth is that when people know there's a disease around, they take better care of their own hygiene. They're more careful. They wash their hands more. They try not to put themselves in situations where they're going to be near sick people. And those behavioral responses make a big difference, and perhaps make a bigger difference even than lockdown policies. And so there are some other states that are still pretty draconian. New York and New Jersey come to mind. Massachusetts, here in the D.C. area, Northern Virginia and Maryland, we have very, very draconian lockdown restrictions still in place. So it's pretty uneven. There are other places. Pennsylvania is not the only one, although I would point out that Michigan, which had been one of the most draconian, has now significantly loosened their gathering limits up to 50 now, and they've opened pools and they've done some other things. And so even the places that have been sort of the most draconian seem to be moving away from that pretty rapidly. And I think the reward for the states that moved early is going to be very large in terms of the economic benefit. And the laggard states like your own, they're going to be playing catch up for months economically as a consequence of these weeks that they're stalling at this point.
We have been talking with Phil Kirpin. Phil is president of the Committee to Unleash Prosperity. And the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, along with FreedomWorks, has put out a report card on how the governors have been doing in the various states relative to reopening their economies. Our governor, Tom Wolf, of course, received an F. So, Phil, tell us a little bit about the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, and where can folks go to read more about this report card?
Well, the committee was originally founded by Steve Moore, Art Laffer, Steve Forbes, and Larry Kudlow during sort of the 2016 election to sort of bring back supply-side principles and ideas and to push for, you know, free markets and free trade and limited government ideas and policies. And we've got a really good, I think, daily newsletter on coronavirus and related economic issues and so forth that people can sign up. It's free on our website that I edit with John Fund and Steve Moore that we send out every morning. And all of our information and everything is on the website, committeetounleashprosperity.com. And you can also find the governor report card there.
Phil Kirpin from the Committee to Unleash Prosperity. Phil, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Have a good one.
Just a short drive north of New York City lies the Westmoreland Sanctuary. It is a nature preserve that offers a wide range of educational and recreational activities. Ann Paul is a member of the Sanctuary Board. She joins Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation in the Community Benefit Spotlight.
Thank you, Loman, and thank you, Ann, for being a guest on the Lincoln Radio program.
Thank you, Joe.
In Westmoreland Sanctuary, would you share with the listeners what was the inspiration for developing this organization? Why did it start? What does it do?
Westmoreland Sanctuary was started in 1968 by Helen Clay Frick, who was Henry Frick's daughter. She had an estate in Bedford and Mount Kisco, New York, and she donated the land. She started out with about 300 acres that she donated. This land was for the free use, enjoyment of the public, and to be enriched by all. So the property then grew from 300 acres to 640 acres through land acquisitions over time.
I understand it's a beautiful tract of land surrounded by wooded countryside. So for people who aren't familiar with the geography, you're not that far at all out of New York City. You're just a little bit north.
Yes. So we're 50 minutes north outside of New York City.
With the natural richness of what the land offers there, what kinds of programs do you do? What is the purpose and mission of the Westmoreland Sanctuary?
Our purpose and mission is to acquire, preserve, and enrich land for the free use of the public and educate environmental education. We perform environmental education programs that meet next generation science standards that are applicable in New York, Connecticut, and surrounding states. These programs are run at a significant discount to service all. We go into schools and schools come to us for field trips, scout programs. We do orienteering meets for adults and families. We do sugar fest for adults and families. And the goal here is to provide environmental education at an affordable price for everyone. We're not a state park. We're not a county park. We're an independent, small public charity that does this work.
And you mentioned to me yesterday that there's a program, there are some people from Pennsylvania coming up to your tract of land to do the orienteering competition. What is an orienteering competition for those that have never experienced it?
Orienteering is a race through the woods with a map and a compass, finding specific points within the woods through a course. And something called a finger stick is attached to your finger, and you insert it, and a time is registered at the specific point. And at the end of the race, the time and the points that are met are tallied. And whoever gets through the race fast enough wins. Now, it's also used in programs for schools to teach about map and compass and topography, which is part of the curriculum in the school system, particularly for sixth grade students.
I understand that you have a beautiful facility on the campus, a reconstructed 200-year-old church, serves as a nature center and museum. Give us a little bit of background on that facility.
The church was originally located on Guard Hill, which is in Bedford, named after a Revolutionary War situation where actually guards marched on the hill to defend us from the British. The church was then moved in the 1970s and reconstructed through independent fundraisers who put the church up. The church actually was a town meeting hall as well as a church, and it was declared in the church after the Revolutionary War was in process that any British sympathizers that were found in town were to be run out of town or face a more a stricter punishment than that. So the church actually houses 13 live animals and exhibits of animals that can be found in the preserve with explanations and identification.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Ann Paul, who is the executive director of the Westmoreland Sanctuary in Upper State, New York. And if you know that this program is broadcast in Pennsylvania, if people from Pennsylvania just want to come up and enjoy the sanctuary, what kind of an experience might they have?
There are 7.5 miles of hiking trails, and local bed and breakfast in Chappaqua and other abilities to stay overnight in the area, particularly in Mount Kisco, Holiday Inn. And you can go to the preserve, which are close to these locations, and go to the free museum. And if you find somebody who's around, they'll let you hold the animals and interact with them, and will explain biodiversity and biomimicry and all sorts of things that you may be interested in. You can then hike the preserve and find all sorts of wildlife. The trails are specifically designed to be away from houses, away from roads, so that you really get that feeling of being submerged in nature in these mature forests and vernal pools and all the things, all the different environments that foster biodiversity.
You also have some lakefront property on your sanctuary.
Lakefront is generous. It's a very large pond, but we call it Betchel Lake, and there is a dock out there, it's created by a 100-year-old farmer's dam, and you can go out on the dock, and we use that to educate students and adults and whoever wants to go out there on pond ecology, particularly pond side ecology, because that's very rich in biodiversity. And there's a little lean-to there that you can sit and enjoy the view. It's a lovely place. I bring my kids there. And they also teach things like survival fishing. And so that there's a lot of different things that you can see there.
And if somebody wants more information about Westmoreland Sanctuary, how can they find you?
You can call. We like calls, 914-666-8448. Or you can go to our website at www.westmoreland.sanctuary.org.
This is Joe Geiger in the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today was Ann Paul, the Executive Director of the Westmoreland Sanctuary. Ann, thank you for being a guest.
Oh, well, thank you for hosting, and it's lovely to share the mission and the presence of Westmoreland Sanctuary with everyone. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you. Back to you, Loman.
Thank you.
Pennsylvania businesses struggling to resume operations following the COVID-19 shutdown need relief from onerous state regulations. So says Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
A recent article by James Pethakalkis asks, "Why can't America build things anymore?" He writes, "A cursory review of American infrastructure over the past half century would suggest that a spate of environmental regulations since the 1970s have raised cost and lengthened build times." Eli Duardo, a policy analyst at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University, points out that the infrastructure projects funded by the 2009 Obama stimulus were subject to nearly 200,000 environmental reviews, during which time they were on hold. This reminds me of an anecdote Tony Martin of Martin's Famous Pastry Shop shared at the facility when it hosted a public hearing on regulatory reform last December. He talked about wanting to change the entrance from one road to another and the five-year ongoing process he was engaged with the DEP. 5 years and the project hasn't yet begun. The good news, both Washington and Harrisburg have acted to reduce the regulatory burden American workers, households, and businesses have to bear. And these actionable steps couldn't have come at a better time for Americans concerned with recovering what's been lost throughout the nation's shutdown. At the federal level, many thanks can be attributed to the Trump administration. The Competitive Enterprise Institute has started a campaign entitled #NeverNeeded to keep the conversation and action going around the continuation of reforms around never-needed regulations that could slow the country's much-needed economic recovery. In May, President Trump signed an executive order that will leave the executive branch with less power to better position the country for economic recovery. CEI recently noted the complexity and pervasiveness of federal rules and regulations make it impossible for anyone to understand genuinely even a fraction of federal law. There are more than 180 federal employment laws and a cabinet department that produces more than 140 million hours of annual compliance burden affecting both employers and employees. Altogether, we suffocate the economy with nearly $2 trillion of red tape. We can do better, and this executive order will put us on that path. In Harrisburg, we have a new chair of the Senate Intergovernmental Operations Committee this legislative session, Senator Doug Mastriano, to thank for state reforms. On May 25th, he ran the state version of the RAINS Act out of committee. Senate Bill 5, sponsored by Senator John DeSanto, would require the General Assembly to vote on any economically significant regulation defined as having an effect on state, municipality, or business community of $1 million or more annually. The House version passed last April. Reforms like this should be sent to Governor Wolf for his signature. As we chart our path to economic recovery in the coming months and years, we must restore balance and cost efficiency to the regulatory culture. This won't only benefit existing businesses as they reopen, but will spark the creation of new ones, making our state more competitive and prosperous. Reducing government-imposed barriers is essential for our Commonwealth to reach its full potential. Here in PA, residents are suffering with almost 1.8 million Pennsylvanians having now filed unemployment claims, or 27% of the workforce. We're going to need to ensure businesses can open as efficiently as possible. You know, Senator Mastriano noted the day of the vote in committee back in May that expensive regulations are just a hidden form of taxation. PA taxpayers also deserve relief after months of forced time away from the workforce. Restoring Harrisburg to its proper constitutional limits by improving our regulatory culture will get us closer to achieving our full economic potential. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director for Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania. To find us on Facebook, search at PAAFP, and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 25 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WKHB-FM in Irwin, WPHB-AM in Phillipsburg, along with WJAS-AM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.